Janelle.
Saeed.
Another episode of Two Writers Talking Shit.
It's crazy. We just keep going and going and going.
It's like the Energizer Bunny.
It's like the Energizer Bunny.
We have here a friend of the podcast. We just did their podcast.
That's right.
That y'all can go listen to right now, Screenwriters Rant Room. The amazing, talented writer, director, graphic novelist.
Yes.
Chris Derrick.
I'm excited.
Man, finally, we finally got you in the building.
Yes.
Look, let's just dive right into it.
I've got nothing to do.
Yeah.
I'm ready to die.
What was the script that opened doors for you?
A script called Mercury Falling.
Okay.
It's a story. It's so basically it's like, it's about Orson Welles, and it's about it's about how after he burned his bridges in Hollywood and he went to Europe and the struggles he had to make his first film in Europe, which was Othello. And it was just, so it just covers this 4-year period from 48 to 52. And it was a movie that, it was a story that was always interested in me. His Othello, when I saw it in college, is what spurred me to become a filmmaker.
Wow.
And then by, you know, how I am, I'm like very into like history and how people do things. And I love the whole history of Hollywood and things like that. And I just took like a deep dive, like in his career. And I remember reading this book called This Is Orson Welles that, that Peter Bogdanovich put together. There's a bunch of interviews that Peter did like over maybe like 6 or 7 years. And the stories about how he made, how, because it took him 4 years to make the movie. Like he shot it over like a year and a half, 2 years, like sort of like a student film on weekends. And he would shoot and, you know, and then he would go and be in like other films or do radio broadcasts and then use that money to bring the crew back. And so there's like, if you look at the movie, there's scenes where it's like he's shooting, like the coverage would be, if you're shooting on me, it might be in Venice. And we're shooting on you, then it might be like 6 months later in Rome. And then we might come back to me for when I'm walking away. And we might be in Morocco because I'm walking outside. So it's this very kind of like weird piecemeal type of film, and I thought it was so fascinating. And the story always interested me, and I really didn't know how it ended. I mean, I knew how it ended. I knew that eventually he won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in '52, but I don't know how he actually got the movie final made.
And what was the name of that movie?
The his film,
yeah.
his version of Othello, the Shakespeare play, and so I, it's always something I love. I was always fascinated by this in terms of like the spirit of like true independent maverick filmmaker.
Yeah,
I mean, I came out here wanted to be a filmmaker, and I was just always, and so many people are influenced by Orson Welles' work, obviously, but I was always like, I was keyed into that struggle in his life, this whole time in Europe and everything after that. Cause it's sort of like you say to yourself, I think the equivalent would be like if Steven Spielberg, if he makes Jaws, and then Suda disappears.
And
you'd be like, wait, what happened?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What happened? Like, how did this happen?
No close encounters,
none of this stuff, you know? So, and then, you know, it happened at a time when I'd been out here for a long time, over 10 years, and I was ready to quit.
Okay, that's motivation for that.
I mean, at the time, I was copywriting for a bunch of companies and like all over the globe with this company I had, and I was doing like graphic design for like some of the studios and their like film posters, like during the award consideration stuff. Mm-hmm. And I did that for like 3 years in a row, and every year I'd be like, and they liked what I did, but I hated it because I was like, I should be making a movie,
Not the poster.
Yeah. You know?
We got you in the wrong place,
but I couldn't. I was gonna quit, and then I wrote the movie. Well, I wanted to write this movie. Oh, a friend of mine sent me this. There's like a clip on YouTube that was like the commentary on that was from Criterion, that was on a Laserdisc that I used to have but lost, like I broke it. I never listened to the second commentary track, but on it was this fascinating story that this one guy said where in like the like 51 or something like that, that Wells met Daryl Zanuck in Cannes at this, and went to his hotel room and said, "I need some money to finish my movie." And he gave him like, I think it was like $100,000 in like seven different currencies.
Oh,
and
shit.
And he said, "Okay, now go finish your movie, but don't bother me again about this." And then I was like, "Oh, that's
what filmmakers want now."
That's the final, in my mind, yeah. I was like, "Oh, that's the piece in the end of the second act," to kind of like, now, like, I was like, so now I know how to tell the story.
That's dope.
And then, but I'd never written a biopic before. Yeah. I had no idea, like, how those films worked. It was a lot of them that had come out. There are these things that are the cradle of the grave, and they don't, that's such a bad way to tell someone's story, in my opinion. Yeah, you know?
I agree.
And so I knew this guy named Scott Alexander, who had written Ed Wood and People vs. Larry Flint. And I had met him when I had ran for the board for the Writers Guild in like 2014. And he said, "If you ever need any help or anything, here's my email." So the first thing I did was, once I heard that story about the money, I was like, and I wrote up an outline for myself. I said, I called up Scott and I said, "How do you and Larry, his partner, do these movies, like these crazy biopics, like Man on the Moon and stuff like that?" And he was like, "Well, I'll tell you. But who's your guy? Like who are you talking about? Like,
who's the movie about?
Like, number one." And I was like, "Man, do I tell you this?"
Because
he's like deep in the system. He'd Oscar me a few times. But then I was like, I had nothing to lose because I'm getting ready to quit the business anyway.
Yeah.
And I told him, and it turned out he was a huge Orson Welles fan.
Right.
And he was like, "Why don't you send me your outline?"
That's fine.
So I sent him the outline. And then I'll never forget this. He called me when they were shooting the Bronco chase for People vs. OJ.
Yeah.
The show.
Oh, shit.
And he called me. He said, "Hey, so what are you doing?" I was like, at the house working. Yeah. I mean, what are you doing?
At the house. Like,
I'm getting ready to shoot the classic Bronco chase scene.
I'm like, "Oh, okay.
So I got a Bronco here, white Bronco here." AC Collins.
Exactly. And I'm like, he's like, "You got time to talk about your outline?" I was like, sure. And I thought it was gonna be like 15-20 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was this 90-minute call.
Holy shit.
You know, and I was I live like two blocks from here, and I just came outside and just walked, and he was talking. He talked me through the outline.
That's tight.
He talked me about the tricks that he, not the tricks, but the technique,
the
tools and techniques of like here's how you write these pictures. Here's what you gotta do, like, when you're writing a feature film. Like, it's all this master class on writing. And he said, what Larry and I do is two things that we do is that we ask ourselves, what's the most pivotal moment in someone's life? You know, and if you look at Larry Flint, it's that trial, because that trial has to do with everything that he does afterwards. Like, he can keep publishing Hustler.
Yeah.
He fights for the defining moment.
Yeah.
And then he said, so that's why it's important to that person. And that's what you write about. And that's why you don't do the cradle to grave thing, which he was like, appreciated and do that. And then he was like, and why is it important to you? I was like, "Oh, okay."
Yeah.
Okay.
And
okay.
Why was it important to you?
So I had to think about that, because I didn't know that when he told me. And I was and he was like, "Well, so think about that and rewatch your outline and send it back to me."
Yeah. And he wanted it back too.
Yeah.
That's fire.
Oh, wow.
That's rare.
Yeah. This wasn't a one-time call.
No.
Oh,
wow. Amazing. Keep going.
So I went back and I rewrote it at it took me like 2 months to rewrite, think about it. And then I sent it back to him, and he said, "This is good. Come to the house and let's have dinner."
Wow.
And I was like, "Come to the house."
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know. Wow.
And then at the house, we were talking about it, and I still didn't have the, why is it important to me? You know, but he had tried to finish Orson Welles's last movie that was unfinished. Like, he tried to put money in
it. Oh,
like,
yeah, I know. Netflix did that, put it later. With a doc, too.
With a doc, But Scott and Larry had, like, take that footage, and he had the footage, and he showed it to me there that after dinner that night, and they showed me, and he was like, is there anything in here that you want to be put into the movie? Or
that's
blah,
amazing.
And he was telling me all these stories, because he knew Wells as, like, final cameraman. And I just was like, okay, now I got to write all this stuff, you know? But Scott's, like, real thing to me about why I wrote the thing, and then I still didn't have why it was important to me. I just wrote the thing, the script. And then he wanted to read it, and I sent it to him. And then he was like, this is really good. But why is it important to you? You know, as he could tell. And I said, but at this point, because he had such... like, he expressed the level of, like, faith in my ability to tell the story.
Yeah, you were all right. Yeah,
you know, and he was like, you know, he made some calls for me to meet some other people and all this kind of stuff. I realized that what was happening in Orson Welles' life was, this was the second act in his life, in his filmmaking career. Because part of the design of the movie is, if he doesn't make this movie and he kind of burned everything in Hollywood, and everyone knows that he's putting his own money into this movie, and he was known as someone who kind of burned a lot of people's money, is going to ruin him. Like, his reputation even more than it was already ruined. And it was like, you can't ever make a movie. And so it was kind of like, he was never going to make a movie again, direct a film, if he didn't get this one film going. And I looked at it as like, do you have a second act in life? And I was like, do I have a second act in my life?
Oh my God, I have a second act.
You know, like, you
do, am I gonna do, get a you second? Do,
so yeah, so I did a draft where I was like, that's like this secondary theme. It's running through the thing, and then I took like all of my bitterness and feeling of being battered by the town, and as a creative, and like sense of like, this early success that I had was all fleeting, and I just was like, in every moment in the movie when he's talking about his own troubles like that, I'm just gonna speak for me. I'm gonna speak. I'm gonna speak with like my truth in that, you know. And I did that, and then I sent the script to Scott again because he wanted to read it. He's like, "Send me the final thing." And I never. And then he called me on like 5 o'clock on like because it was on New Year's Eve.
Oh,
what?
He called me one time on five. I sent it to him like we had coffee around Thanksgiving. He's awesome. Send me a script. I was like, I'll read it. I said, take me a while because you know the Oscar stuff. I'm reading a lot. I was like, okay, sure. And I thought, well, he'll call me once the Oscar nominations are out and all this kind of stuff like this. But he called me on New Year's Eve and he said, hey, you got 5 minutes? And I was like, yeah.
Don't you love it when the important people say, do you have a minute?
Yeah, you have a minute. And then
you're at the altar about to get married. You're like, 1 second, step away, take the call.
And then he kind of went through like, a production rewrite.
Okay, notes, that's fine.
Like notes with me. Like he was like, hey, you should take these two scenes and combine them because you're saying something that can be done in like one scene and
that's
then
fire.
And then you're saving a location. And he's like, hey, this other, there's a moment, there's a really interesting moment with Wells where he meets Winston Churchill. Wow. And it happened in real life. It was just after the war, like, and when Winston was out of office before he came back. And he said, if there's a way you can do that where it sort of happens off screen, but it doesn't happen because you pull attention away from the story to, oh, he's meeting Winston Churchill. And it's like, so it's just as this moment where that the spotlight on your main character gets pulled off for a moment that's unnecessary. And he's like, so can you make that change? And he was like,
Interesting. And
he was like, in this scene, can you make them funnier because you got something funny here, but there's a way you can make it just find another joke, like visual. And I was like, shit, man, I'm just like taking all these notes like real fast and blah, blah, blah. And then he was like, good. Now you actually make this movie. And if you want to send this to some people and you want a recommendation, you got my number.
Wow.
You know? And then from there, I sent it to Glenn Mazzara, who had been like a big fan and a mentor of me. And he loved it. And he was like, I need to get you on a show of mine. And he's getting me on a show of mine. And so, and that was the script that, like, That was just, you know.
How long did it take you to write that script? I'm just curious.
It took me really, really long. It took me because I had this kind of like a block, right? Like after I met with Scott at his house, and he was like, "Send me the script," and I was like, "How do I?
What do I do?
This is like wait, sort of Damocles, like it better be good, kind of thing."
Yep.
And for like 4 months. At that point, I'd already kind of written a draft. And I got stuck at like 35 or 40, something like that. And I just couldn't get the rest of it.
Yeah.
For like months.
Yeah.
Literally months. And then I was like trying to write a page or two there, and I was working another job, and then eventually. I got this coach, right? Oh. And she was like, "What's the problem of a bond?" I was like, "I'm gonna finish your script, and I can't, and other stuff, and also all this going on." She was like, "Hey, this is what you need to do. Here's your plan. You need to," and she was like, "So on Sundays, so do you have 3 hours on Sunday?" I was like, "Yeah, I have 3 hours on Sunday." She was like, "You commit to yourself 3 hours on Sunday. And then every Sunday, you're going to go and you're going to write on that script."
Oh, shit.
And then if you get any free time during the week, then that's just gravy. But you in your mind will know that you've done at least 3 hours on your script every week. And then and then I would always have a call with her on Thursdays, like an accountability call. And she would say, "Well, what happened?" And I was like, "Well, I got 3 hours in, and I got like another like 30 minutes in, like before I went to work on this day." She's like, "Good." And then once I was on that like thing, it maybe took me like 2 months to like write it and get it in the version that then I then sent to Scott, that he was like, that resulted in the call on New Year's Eve.
That's fire.
That was the change.
And was that a writing coach or a business coach?
It's a business coach.
Business coach. And would you recommend that?
Yeah. Yeah. Because she like taught me about the Eisenhower box. She taught me about, I don't know if you guys know what the Eisenhower box is.
I don't know what that is. Do you know?
No, you did say it, please.
So it's this thing that that Dwight Eisenhower, the president, the general at D-Day, I guess he put it together like during planning D-Day or somewhere during World War II, where it's a box that's divided into four squares. And there's like, and the squares are, there's something urgent and important in square one. There's urgent and unimportant in square two. There's urgent and not important, you know, it's broken down and not urgent and important and not important and not urgent. And he's like, and she was like, "You gotta like look at your week and fill out the box."
Yeah.
And that way you're not thinking about what's my to-do list for the week. It's like, what do I do? Like, I mean, every day, to do this every day, it's like, it's like, hey, for this week, I do this. Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah. And then, so I use that. I mean, for a long time, I used to have that on my wall. Like, I made it really big. Like, I made it like, it's probably like 4 feet by 4 feet, maybe even bigger than that. I just taped it off, and then I would use post-it notes to put it on there. And then I would, and then I started doing that to like help me with scripts. Like if I got a script idea, I would say, so where's it going in the box? So I can address it when, or I could do a rewrite on this, and then I got it down to like, I can do a rewrite on act one now, today. That's the main thing, and then shuffle it around. So it kind of helped me kind of like, it organized myself like creatively, and then it allowed me to like, you know, because I was freelancing with my design company, graphic design company, and that was like taking up so much time, because it's like, I'm doing the work, I'm doing the business development, I'm doing all this kind of crazy stuff, and I just wouldn't have time for anything. Like, my life was out of control, and so she helped me get my life like more organized, because I can be very disciplined on things, you know, and get stuff done, but it's like, how do you prioritize, and also like, when do you say, I gotta stop on this, and then jump on something else, you know, which I do now when I'm writing. You know, like today, for instance, I was like, I'm reading the Fuller thing to help me with the horror film that I'm working on. I have this, there's another show that I got notes on from my managers, and I was like, okay, I'm gonna do that today before I come to do this podcast. So what's the priority, should I do, and work on this video too. And I just, before I came here, I was like, okay, well, I did the script, so I'm gonna
take
pull
that off.
The box. So that was the That's the method.
I gotta get some boxes up.
You gotta get some boxes. And you gotta get some. Yeah, you,
nice
you
to have
tape
a big
up.
Wall like that, isn't it?
Well, take whatever's on the wall off, because now you're about to have Eisenhower box.
Eisenhower box.
I like that. Yeah, everybody look that up.
Yeah.
Quick question. You brought up managers. 99.9% of the people that listen to this podcast want managers.
Mm-hmm.
Question is, do you have any advice on what they should look for or what they should ask their manager when they sit down the first time or whatever? Like just the initial stages of like looking for a manager. What are some qualities you think that they should be looking for and red flags possibly?
Well, I think you have to look for, you got to ask questions about their alignment with the goals you have.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause I've had a lot of reps.
Mm-hmm. Speak
on
it.
Early on, this is like in the late, no, it's like right after Sundance, so 2003, we were with an agency, and it's like we just wanted to be with an agency, mm-hmm. you know? So we went with these people because they'll come at you with a song and dance about mm-hmm. what they can do and what all mm-hmm. they're speaking this language that sounds so much like, you know, like Sammy and what makes Sammy run kind of thing, Sammy Glick. And you're just like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And you as a writer don't always feel the imposter syndrome is hitting at you. The time that wasn't a phrase, but you want someone to support you.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of can override your sense of discernment.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to ask about their alignment for you, and you got to listen to what they're pitching to you and realize that maybe they'll only do 20% of what they're pitching.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, wow, 20% is so little. It's like, well, you know what? You haven't earned them any money.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the main thing that gets them to move, is if you've made them money. And then are you like calling and whining about like, and like, you know, yeah. And it's like, how self-directed are you as a writer? Because I think what everyone doesn't quite understand is there's an image of the manager, the literary agent that we've seen from movies and TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's what they actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And what they actually do in the last 15 to 20 years has gotten very, very narrow. And that had to do with the way they would package stuff with television and with movies. So the agents and the managers didn't really have to do anything because, hey, I'm the big showrunner or the screenwriter or the director. I come in with this thing, and then, you know, like, I sell to NBC, and then they're like, okay, cool, we'll package it, and we'll just put all our people on from our agency, and we don't have to do much of anything, and just, you know, and we'll just shuffle the clients around. So there was no real like sense of like, I got to go out and find work and do all this kind of stuff that, you know, that you think about, you know, and help my client and help cultivate my client's career. Like, they don't do that anymore because they haven't needed to do that for 20 years because of the packaging. They were like, well, if you're at William Morris and there's a showrunner who's got a show with William Morris, you have a shot to get on
that show.
And if you're not at William Morris and that show's a William Morris show, then your chance to get in is so small unless you know him from something else. So that's this thing that, you know, you have to kind of get a sense of like how much they, about how they're going to work for you. So that's some, you just got to realize that. I think you want to ask them like, what's their management style?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, like, what do you guys like to do? And is it a weekly call, or what are we doing? Or is it not a weekly call? Is it whenever you something pops up? You know, with my managers now, it's like my fourth one. I hit them up when I have questions about stuff, like if I want information. Mm-hmm. Like the one thing they're all good at, like
reading them motherfucking deadlines.
The thing they're all, I mean, the thing that you have to really realize is the main thing they can do is be like, you know, I don't say like spies, but they're like your intelligence agency. And they can find this out, and they can get this, and you know, and can you find out about X, Y, and Z? Or I heard about, you know, I mean, again, like you guys said, I mentioned earlier about I sent the Orson Welles thing to Glenn Mazzara. You know, I mean, like, I knew him from before. I knew him from like 7-8 years before that. I met him at a panel, and I did not know him at all. And it was this thing on like, on like good, I'm like, how do I write your best spec? When they used to do specs. And I walked out to him after the panel and, you know, and I said, Mr. Mazzara, I love this episode of The Shield you did, and like told him when it was and said, this episode, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, look in his face. He was like, wait a minute, you know my Shield episode? Yeah. And I said, what's your name? I was Chris Derrick. Me and my brother write together. I was like, look, I have a script that I would love for you to take a look at. And the look in his face was like,
I know, yeah.
No, man, come on.
I was liking you until then.
But the thing is, he kind of opened that door during his speech. He was like, hey, come up, you know, meet people, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And I was like, well, but see, what I did is I said, look, just read the teaser. And if you don't like it, don't call me.
The great pitch.
You know?
Yeah, great pitch.
And he was like, don't call you? I was like, I'm never going to call you.
Fire.
I was like, because
I don't have your number.
I was like, I'm not gonna badger you.
Yeah.
And he was like, okay, send me the script.
So
he gave me my email and I sent it to him like the next day, and then like 3 months later he got back to me and he called me. He said, this is really good. I like this a lot. This is a TV pilot. But I bring it up because my manager called me right before Thanksgiving. They said, hey, there's a show that...
Strategic. You're being strategic.
There's a show that we think that you would really be good for, and the showrunner is Glenn Mazzara. And I think you told us that you know him. I was like, of course I know Glenn. Mm-hmm. I'm going to call Glenn. I'm going to call him right now. Yeah, facts. I didn't even like text him. I was like, hey, Glenn... Because he and I had just worked on the strike rules committee. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and apparently they talked like... the woman who rents it from the guild, she told me when she and I were drinks one time, she was like, you were the first name that he mentioned.
That's tight.
And she said that Glenn was like, you got to get Chris Derrick on this committee with me. I was like, okay, cool.
That's tight. You know,
cool. And so, but that's the thing. It's like the manager knew that information. She did all that research about what it was. And she called me, said, hey, I know this show is good for you. And I think you remember you said you know the guy.
Yeah.
So I was like, so then it's up to me to kind of like, then like, you know, what's the Rolodex like, you know? Because I told them when I signed with them, I said, look, you know, like, sure, Star Trek's my first show, but I've been out here for a while and I know a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So when I tell you, like, hey, like, I know so-and-so's on the show, running the show, I'm not saying, like, I know them, like, I've hung out with them or blah, 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 like, or met them at a mixer. It's like, I may have been to their house.
Yeah.
I may have had dinner with them a couple times. I can get to them in a way where I'm not just, like, a business relationship kind of thing. You know, it's not, like, a ton of people, but there's a good maybe 10 or 15 people like that, you know?
Which is a difference maker if it's a stack of 200 scripts.
For sure. For sure. Because the first thing that Glenn said when I called him, I said, hey, Glenn, I'm gonna be here for the show. And he was like, oh, well, where's your stuff? Because I didn't see your name on the list. And if I did, I would have marked it immediately.
Yeah.
Mm. And I was like, oh, I thought my people, in my mind, I was like, I thought they had sent the stuff over. Yeah. So I had to hang up and call them and say, guys, send this over now. Like, he's like waiting for it now. But it's like, you know, but that's the thing you had to play. And so you had to kind of like use your managers as like, they're part of your team. Mm-hmm. But you're still like in charge and you got to direct them and like you got to think. So there's all these questions. It's like, what's the style? And if you call them a lot, then like how much currency are you burning with them?
That's a really important note about like how much currency are you burning? Because you don't want to burn out. Mm-hmm. You don't want to burn out. Mm-hmm. I mean, for instance, like, you know, our lawyers make 5% of what we do. So they're even making less than your agent and your manager. And my lawyer is at like a very big, fancy, like A-list Hollywood place. And I probably make the least amount of money for her of like all her clients, right? And then a previous manager I had fully burned out that currency on some absolute bullshit, like of, you know, like a script I had written with someone who like didn't want to give me like the rights to it or whatever. It was just not going to lead to anything. And it was just not going to lead to my lawyer making any money. And I so regret that. Like those, you know, all the email chain and like the hour long phone call, you know, because it's like, it takes time to build that currency, like back up.
A lot.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and well, and then the thing is, I mean, like, honestly, to build it back up, you got to make them a lot of money.
That's right. That's how you build the currency back up.
Yeah. You know, and it's weird because it's like, wow, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, or you could kind of like, if you show them you're doing a lot of work without them, like, hey, I got this meeting. I'm just letting you know. Then they're like, oh, mm-hmm. okay, well, he's, you know, he or she doesn't like need me right now. Yeah. And they're not sitting on their thumbs waiting for me to do something. They're like running, which gives them, the currency is also sort of like their faith in you. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. We signed you because mm-hmm. you had the energy and the wherewithal to get this project in front of us somehow, you know? I mean, like the guys I'm with now, you know, I got them because I got them when I was on Star Trek. I mean, yeah. I was with somebody else when I got on Star Trek, but I got on Star Trek through my own hustle.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a project that I was trying, that I was ready to pitch. And I like told people about it, and it was a deck and like all this stuff. And my managers were like, they didn't want to do anything with it. They were like, see, I mean, I remember checking this recently because looking for see if I had contact with someone. And I realized that it's like, I told them the script was ready and we had a call about it in like April of 2021. And then in September, I was like, what's going on? Like, yeah. Where's the meeting? Mm-hmm. Where's the set? Yeah. Can you sit it out? Can you sit this thing out? Yeah. And I was like, and I kind of didn't follow up with them like originally because there was a lull between season 2 and season 3 in Star Trek, which mm-hmm. is why I was like, hey, I got some time, can we try to run with this? Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, like, Star Trek became insane. Mm-hmm. Like, that third season was this thing where it was like, we had to be there at 9, left at 7. Mm-hmm. It was out in Santa Clarita, so it was an hour drive each way. It was this intense. It was work day, which is a lot long. I mean, I was like, oh, 9 to 7, that's not long. I mean, considering that most writers' rooms are like 10 to 5, you know, that's a long room, 9 to 7.
That is a long room.
Yeah, it's a very long room, yeah. You know. And I was like, hey, I'm sitting there just collecting a check mm-hmm. that was a job that I got. Mm-hmm. And then for me to stay on it, like, and they also didn't know if I was going to get bumped from like staff writer to story editor. Like, that was something that like I had to like, call a bunch of friends of mine who were shorters and say, well,
how does this work?
What do I do? Blah, blah, blah. And because my managers were like, we're afraid to call.
They were afraid to call.
They're like, well, we didn't want to ruffle any butts. I was like, you need to find out if I'm getting
my job.
Yeah. So the current guys I have, like the co-EP on Star Trek who helped, you know, he heard me one time, like, I was griping like in my office, you know, and he was like, hey, yeah, what's going on? I was like, oh, this. And he was like, oh, you know what? I'll have you meet my guys.
That's tight.
And I was like, oh, okay. So, so there it is, you know? And he said to me, look, and he's like, I got to tell you something. They won't bullshit you. I was
that's
like,
tight.
And he was like, what do you mean? And I was like, and he was like, you know how everyone is in this town. They like to bullshit you about work and everything. And I was like, oh, okay, wait a minute. This guy, the way he was in the room, he's like a no bullshit guy. Like mm-hmm. he didn't brook any of this kind of bullshit. He's a very nice guy. Love him. I mean, cool guy. Yeah. But you always tell that he was never about like, that I don't want to deal with all this kind of like the bad fake pleasantries. Like that wasn't his thing. So when he told me that, I knew that if they passed his test, then I could trust them because I trusted him. Yeah. And plus he helped me out so much.
Yeah.
Like he did something that like was so endearing to me mm-hmm. is that like on my second season of Trek, he came on because he knew Terry from 12 Monkeys. And I remember I was sitting in my office like one day, like second or third week in the room, and he didn't know the rest of the staff, so it was just trying to like
navigate.
But he knew Terry and Chris, and this guy's Sean. But Sean came in my office one day and he said, "Hey man, here's what's happening right now. Blah blah blah. You're probably thinking this. You're probably feeling this." And he just kind of walked me through this sense of like, "Don't worry, it's gonna be cool." Like just like, I mean, kind of walked me through like how to navigate the emotions of what was happening you know, and he was like, look, I'm here. I've known Terry for a long time. Like, Terry, like, said, we're not like this. You might not know this. And it was just not Terry running it because Akiva had left. And he kind of just like gave me this sort of like a pep talk. Like, so just, he was like, look, just be there every day. And like, don't worry about this. And if there's nothing to do, you should work on your own stuff. Like, I'm letting you can do that. And no one's going to get mad. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, okay.
That's tight.
So now I feel like I'm really part of the team now because he's like giving me this kind of this license to be like, you know, because he'd been with Terry, like because Terry gave him his first job on 12 Monkeys, and he was on Show Me for all four seasons. So he had this. So, but I was like, oh, like you need people to be like your allies and 100%. Stuff like this. So when he was like talking to my manager, I was like, okay, I can like trust you, you know. Yeah. So
what's crazy is, did you just say that Star Trek is your first show you was on, Picard?
Yeah.
That's fucking insane, bro.
That is crazy.
Like, this one, Star Trek is your first show. It wasn't like some kids show that
wasn't like Bluey.
Yeah, it wasn't like Bluey or like, okay. No. That's wow, bro. So real quick, how was it? Do you have any advice for preparing for a writer out there that's about to go into a room? Do you have any preparation advice you should tell them?
Yeah, I mean, there was a... So, you know, like I've been to all these panels and like staffing and blah, 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 the guild that they have. And obviously, if you haven't been in the guild, because I got in the guild right from writing features.
Yeah.
And then you kind of like, how does television staffing work? And what's the room? What's the protocol as staff writer? And I remember there was somebody on Twitter posted this. Mm-hmm. It was like, here's my staff writer cheat sheet.
Okay.
And it was this one page thing that she wrote that was like a, you know, those like 6x9 notebooks, the spiral thing that flipped to the top. She had like written all this stuff down. And so like I took like a, I just downloaded that thing from Twitter and I was like, okay. And I took it and blew it up and like, and made my own version of it. And it was all these little things about like, you know, the improv thing, like about, hey, like do the yes and don't be like cutting stuff off, you know, I mean, but that's I think the best advice I got was from David Goyer, who'd been a mentor of mine. And if you guys who don't know, like he wrote Blade, he wrote Batman. He has Foundation on the TV right now on Apple. And I mean, I'm not named. I mean, but it's just like you got to think about like who I am. But I don't mean to. But it's like you got to think about like who is telling you certain things. You know? I mean, and David, I think his first credit was like Bloodsport or some shit like that.
Wow.
Like back in the early 80s. Yeah. So he's like been around forever. And he said to me, I was calling him like the second or third day in the room of Star Trek. I was like, dude, this is like, can we just talk? Because I don't know how to navigate this. Like, also the people told me like was kind of like not coming out in my actions. And he said, look, here's your thing you got to remember. I'm going to give you two things. One, there's three types of writers in the television show. There's someone who's good on the page, someone who's good on the room, and there's someone who's good at both. And he said, you got to figure out where you are. And then, like, you should lean into that because then everyone's going to know what your value is to the room. And he's like, if you don't get a script, because there's not one assigned to you, and he's like, that might not be true because of your staff writer, then you can't demonstrate that you're good on the page yet. So then you really got to say, I got to now be good in the room on some level. And I said, okay, so my plan is, I just want to say one thing that sticks on the board every day. You know, and that so that might mean that like I don't talk all day, but then get that one thing.
Yep.
But the only thing about that is I learned quickly is
that one thing better be there.
is that something might stay for like the morning?
Yeah, if you go.
And then afternoon, so like we're not and you're like, now we gotta do another one. Now I gotta figure out the next thing. Because the thing is that, you know, on Star Trek what I realized is, you know, everyone was sort of kind of getting on the same wave of what was happening. And then because like I wasn't used to knowing how to jump, like time it right. Oh, so the minute someone's voice, like their lips shut, oh, I'm in. You know, like there's this thing that you got to like
plan the timing of the room.
And I was having trouble with that. And so I realized that like there were so many things I wanted to say. I was like, when I get the, and then someone would say it. I was like, fuck,
motherfucker.
Now I gotta keep thinking.
That's the improv of it all.
Because
you gotta be aware, like, you can't, you know what I mean? Like, shit, they said it, you better come up with another.
Come on, someone else. And then the other thing is, so that's like a big thing, is like, you just gotta stay in the moment of what's happening and just kind of keep assessing where the story's going, where's the story's going. And then the big thing is also is like, when you pitch an idea, and it gets rejected, you might want to fight for it one time if it's like a big idea, but if it's not, let it go. Because if you don't let it, here's the thing about letting it go. And I just had dinner with the guy last night who was the co-creator of that show called Sleeper Cell, with Michael Ealy from like, I don't know, 10, 15
back
years
in
ago.
The day.
And I was telling him, I said, yeah, man, like the thing is that like, if you are a writer, if you're a creative person and your idea gets shot down, don't you have another one?
Yeah.
Because that's your job.
That's right.
So if it gets shot down, don't feel butthurt. Throw another idea out the way. Throw another idea out the way. I remember there was a panel I did with, I didn't on it, but I remember watching it. It was with Ron Moore and Damon Lindelof. Mm-hmm. They were talking about writing sci-fi. I remember that Damon said this really cool thing. He said that breaking the episode is like there's a castle, and inside the courtyard is the episode break.
Oh shit!
But everyone is outside trying to storm the castle. And he was like, everyone's idea is a body that dies in the moat or on the wall, and until someone climbs up all the dead bodies and jumps over. So you got to be comfortable dying all the time with your ideas. Mm-hmm. So that someone, and it might be you, gets like you know, here's this final piece that does the episode break. You know, so that's your.
I have a quick question before we wrap in a moment. You were talking about how those initial managers you had, you were a staff writer, you were like, am I going to get bumped up to story editor? They were too afraid to call your showrunner. So you asked the showrunner directly. And then what did the showrunner say about how you get bumped up from staff writer to story editor?
Oh, well, see, I didn't ask the showrunner on my show. I didn't ask him that. I asked some other showrunner friends of mine. And they were like, do you know if they're bringing you back or not? Mm. And I was like, I don't know. I just don't know. And then he said to me, so when was your contract up? I was like, oh, well, it was up 20 weeks ago. And they have us on this week-to-week thing. And then they were like, oh, you're coming back.
Yeah.
He's like, you're coming back for sure. I said, but what about the promotion? And then he was like, okay, well, and he was like, well, have your people ask or ask the number two or just like, you have to kind of do it subtly. And then something crazy happened. It was like, I was like, okay. So then I went, so that afternoon, it was like at lunch, I made that call. That afternoon, we sat down in the writer's room and we'd been talking about season two all morning because we're still trying to like, they're filming it and we were trying to figure out the last two episodes. And then I remember that we sat down and Akiva was like, so welcome to season three. Now here's the
problem. Oh, you know, whoa. You just kicked in the.
So to me, I was like, now
I'm on season three.
I was like, okay, now what does this mean? Because now I'm back for the third season.
Yeah.
But did I get the bump?
Did you get the bump?
And then I called up my buddy Joe Wilson, who then hired me on the Equalizer the next year. I said, Joe, what the fuck, man? What's going on? And he was like, did they talk about season three stuff? I was like, yeah. And he was like, go home, pop some champagne, you'll be back. And you know what? If they're bringing you back, then they're gonna give you the bump.
That's tight, bro.
You know. Okay. And then I was like, okay, cool. And then checks came, and there was no bump. But then I forgot the checks were like a couple weeks late
dated
on the thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then when the check came, it said season three. It said story editor, and there was more money. I was like, oh well, there you go. I'm good.
Okay.
I love this story. So here's our last question for upcoming writers. What are five scripts you think they should read?
TV or film?
It could be a mix of both.
Okay,
but
so
give me five.
Like I always say, you should read Michael Clayton. Mm-hmm. I always say you should read The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
I think for most people who write genre, I would say you should take a look at the Expanse script, because it's crazy what they were able to put on the page. That wasn't even designed to be like on the show. Just all these notes and like definitions. I was like, you can do all this? So that's really cool. I think you should, which I've written, I liked, is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend is a good script.
Nice.
And then I also like the, the fifth one, I don't know.
I already know one that you're probably going to say. What is the movie with Jack Nicholson? Do you like that one?
What, As Good As It Gets?
No, the classic one where his ear rips. He's a detective.
Oh, Chinatown. Chinatown. Okay, yeah.
That's five. Perfect.
Yeah. Well, look, man, we're going to have you back for another episode, and we're going to have you on with Hilliard for Screenwriters Rant Room. But where are you at on the socials? Give it to us.
You can get me at Unauthorized CBD. That's the best way to reach me on the socials. You could follow my Substack, which is ChristopherDerrick.substack.com. Or you could go to Comics Rot Your Brain, which would be the new podcast, and there's a way to contact us. There's comicsrotyourbrain.com, like on that website. So that's the best way to reach me.
Appreciate it. Mel, another dope episode.
Another amazing episode, Zaid.
Another dope writer.
The hits just keep on coming.
And, you know, people are commenting that they like the show, which is dope.
And please, please comment. Please rate us 5 stars. Please, we do it all for you. The least you can do is rate us 5 stars, share us with your friends, and write an amazing, glowing review. It's not so much to ask.
And for the person that wrote a glowing review but accidentally hit a 1, please make sure that when you leave a glowing review, you hit the 4.
The 5! The five!
Somebody hit 1. It was like a good review. This podcast, 1. I was like, oh, you got this backwards. The system of rating. Like, maybe for them, 1 is the best.
Yeah. It's 5. It's the star all the way to the right.
Please, 5, not 1. Yeah, exactly. All right, y'all. Another episode.
Bye.
Two Writers Talking Shit is an original podcast created by Melanie Mars and Saeed Crumple. Our producer is Kayla Guest. Our audio engineer is T. Kelly.
Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you damn well please. All we ask is that you subscribe, rate us 5 stars, and give us a glowing review.
If you're not going to give us 5 stars or any glowing reviews, then why even log on? Save your rants for an open mic.
If you have any questions for us, and I do mean any, you can email us at twowriterstalkingshit@gmail.com. That's the number 2, and then writerstalkingshit@gmail.com.
See you next episode.
Bye.